is once both parties have appeared, and assume that means their answer has been filed when they've appeared.
Okay, so 2091 is the one that just simply raises it from 15 to 20, and is, I don't see that the bar is signed up to offer the amendments offered in the House. Mm-hmm.
They sent a letter to the committee. Well, they CC'd the committee on a letter they sent to the Chief Justice March 30th, 1987, and one of our staff people had talked to Mr. Thorpe, who wrote the letter.
Mr. Who?
Lawrence Thorpe, who had written the letter, and this was a few days ago, and at that time he had indicated that they were interested in offering the amendments. So if they don't, that would be fine with us.
Senator Hamby.
I just moved on to 2092, and it just dawned on me that district court, court's jurisdiction is at 10. So if we allow this to move up to 10, what jurisdiction is held left? Help me with that.
Besides criminal case jurisdiction and juvenile criminal case, I guess.
Again.
Yeah, if this would essentially, if it's raised to the 10,000, it would offer the potential to divert all claims for recovery of money or damages up to 10,000. So that would be almost all the cases in district court.
Only relief claim for recovery,
Is there any discussion in the House Committee on that issue?
Not that I recall, except that when the Commission presented it, they said this is what you passed last time and this is just seeing it through, and someone raised the question as you did, and then that's where it went. So,
well, the district court, in an amount exceeding $15,000 in the circuit court.
Excuse me, are you looking at 2092 or 2091?
2092. Circuit court jurisdiction, if this bill passes, is going to be 10,000 to 25,000. Now, what does this do for district court jurisdiction?
It changes the claim amount for the mandatory arbitration program from 3,000 up to 10,000.
Max?
Yeah.
Max.
That's what I was wondering.
Right now it's at 3,000 and their jurisdiction is up to 10,000 in civil.
There would be no,
there'd be very
for district court in the recovery
in civil,
of
civil. There would be very few cases that would still, civil cases that would still be there.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, the statute provides for mandatory arbitration, but it also provides that if one of the participants is not happy with the arbitration, that they may then take the matter back before the court. So it's not clear how many of those cases between $3,000 and $10,000 would be final at arbitration and how many would come back into court. I would assume that the statistics that currently exist for circuit court might help us with that, but at least some of those cases would be, appealed is not the right word, but the parties would continue them back into district court because they were not satisfied with the arbitration.
The Multnomah program in circuit court, their appeal rate has been about 12 to 13%. It's the testimony presented at the on the House side.
But if you don't recover more than you recovered from the arbitrator, you get stuck with the costs.
I don't know if that's
It's been a while since I've looked at the statute.
In there now. That was something why they were saying that their appeal rate was higher than the national one, which was like 6 to 7%. They said because there wasn't
That's the procedure in Multnomah County now.
A punitive one. Oh, that may be under their local rules. Didn't remember that being in the statute. Let's see. This appeal. Yeah. Let's see, 33.402D is what you said. It's notwithstanding any other provision of law, ORCP, whose position under the arbitration decision award is not improved as a result of a judgment in the action on the trial de novo, shall not be entitled to attorney's fees or costs and disbursements, and shall be taxed the costs and disbursements of the other parties to the action on the trial de novo. So you're correct. They have some punitive sanction in there.
Well, yeah, punitive is one word to use for it, but another word is just to say a powerful disincentive from people to appeal.
That would probably be a better word to use
for it. Well, I'm not. Yeah. I don't mind your word, but I'm just saying that not very many people and there are going to go back in and ask for a trial. I can't speak for them, but I don't think a lot of district court judges are wild about arbitration in district court, because one of the reasons why a lot of district court judges want consolidation is because they'd like to be able to try civil cases with juries. And that is just one more thing. So you've now testified on 2091 and 2092. Are there any other people here who want to testify on either one of those two bills? Okay.
Thank you.
We'll put these back on for work session. Diana Godwin, yes, did you want to testify on 2091?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, briefly. Diana Godwin, representing the Oregon State Bar. I apologize. We had planned to have a member of the Bar's Judicial Administration Committee present today to detail to you some of their concerns about the increase in the mandatory arbitration limits. The Oregon State Bar and the Judicial Administration Committee do support increases in the mandatory arbitration limits. But at the same time, when you're going to increase that jurisdictional limit, you're going to be calling on many more lawyers to provide arbitrator services, because you're going to have more cases going to mandatory arbitration where you're raising the limits. The concern our lawyers have raised and our Judicial Administration Committee members feel very strongly about this is that currently the arbitrators who are called on to handle these cases are inadequately compensated. And as such, we are subsidizing the civil court system by providing our services at far less than the market rate. Also, where public facilities are not provided for these arbitrations, we are also providing often our own attorney conference rooms and staffs to further handle these matters. And that is why our Judicial Administration Committee wrote the letter to Chief Justice Peterson and wanted to bring it to your attention that while they do support the increase in the limits, we feel it's appropriate for the legislature to address the concerns of inadequate compensation and having lawyers further subsidize the judicial system in this area. As I said, I apologize. We had anticipated having a member of our Judicial Administration Committee here today.
The Court Administrator's Office forwarded along with their testimony a letter from the Chief Justice to the Chair,
yes,
Dick Springer of the House Judiciary Committee, and he says in that letter, in which he opposes your amendments.
Yes,
he says that he's not aware of any widespread. There has been no widespread criticism that the compensation is inadequate.
that's not my impression, but I'm not the Chief Justice either. Maybe I have been listening in the wrong places. What do you know about whether there's widespread criticism that the payment is inadequate?
I don't have that information. I believe our Judicial Administration Committee would.
As I recall, you pay the arbitrator, each party pays the arbitrator $300. Isn't that right?
I believe it's less than that. At one time when...
50 each?
Yes. When I have served as an arbitrator in the circuit court for Multnomah County, and I, you know, have been on this list of volunteer arbitrators, at that time the absolute maximum that could be paid to an arbitrator was $150, notwithstanding that you might have put in 10, 20, or 30 hours hearing a case, doing pretrial motions, providing your conference room and your staff, and I have done that. At that time, it was a an absolute maximum of $150, $30 an hour for no more than 5 hours. I believe that has been increased since that time, and each side, you're correct, Mr. Chairman, does pay one half of that to the arbitrator.
Yeah, so it's one half of $300 each pay.
At this point, I believe it has been increased in Multnomah County.
I've been gone from my office 4 months now, I guess, so I'm starting to forget already. But and then the arbitrator... If one of the things my associate used to do these, and if the parties settle it and you haven't gotten the money yet, then you've got to chase them around if you want.
And I have handled all pretrial matters on an arbitration myself personally and not received yet that money from each side, and then have them settle the day before the case and still not having sent in their money. And there you are. And I believe this does happen.
Strikes me as the pay is worse than indigent defense pay.
Pretty soon you're going to have, Mr. Chairman, another little fund to do the arbitrator's fund, just like the indigent defense.
They sock the parties.
I know.
I don't think you're going to see that happening. But I wonder why people want to do it, other than the interesting experience.
Well, because lawyers are committed to doing their share of public service. Always have been.
It's an interesting endorsement of lawyers, really, that people want to take this away from the citizens and give it to the lawyers to make the decisions, because that's what this is doing. It's taking it away from the jury and saying that we want to have the lawyers make the decision. But I imagine if the Chief Justice is arrayed strongly against an amendment and it didn't get put in the House, we'll see what happens in the work session. I doubt if it'll get put in the Senate either, but...
But my committee did ask me to bring it to your attention.
I'm sure this is a subject we're going to hear more about, because unless somebody thinks they're going to become a judge someday or something like that, it's a little silly to do something like this for $300, and you have to be the collection officer, and so on. But
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Even legislators get better paid than that. We're going to have to stand up and tell everybody about our per diem one of these days. Let's see. Where are we? 2185. Who signed up? Linda Zuckerman. This is court day here. Mr. Linden is down putting on the finishing touches of getting $50 million. We mentioned indigent defense. We hear that a breakthrough has been made.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Judicial Department has requested House Bill 2185 that relates to the handling of funds that the courts hold in trust for litigants in the state court system. Funds sometimes are paid into the court by litigants either at the beginning or during the course of proceedings, and frequently those are held until the case is disposed of. When the court receives these funds, they're placed in a trust fund account that is in the state treasurer's office. The most common kind of case that where we're dealing with substantial amounts received in trust are condemnation cases by governmental entities for the entity at the beginning of the case will tender into court for a deposit in a trust account an amount that is determined by it to be the fair market value of the property. Some other typical sources of court trust funds which generally are in smaller amounts than condemnation cases, include, for example, undertakings on appeal, monies that are deposited in interpleaders, rent monies that may be paid into court in FED cases, security posted by criminal defendants, bail, and unclaimed funds. At present, these funds are handled typically in two ways. Usually, they're accepted by the courts and placed in a trust fund, and while they're held in trust with the state treasurer's office, they are accruing interest, and that interest that is earned accrues to the state general fund. In a very limited number of cases, the trial courts have ordered that the funds be placed in interest-bearing accounts with the interest payable to a party. Section 1 of House Bill 2185 statutorily validates the existing practice whereby the interest in the trust account accrues to the general fund. Section 2 provides that where the trust amount is $10,000 or more, a court on the motion of a party can order that it be deposited with the state treasurer and earn interest for a specific party. The primary reason for requesting this bill is our recognition that the state's historical practice of handling interest from trust fund varies from the common principle that principle follows interest. We feel that it would be appropriate for the legislature to sanction affirmatively what has in fact been a longstanding custom. The $10,000 amount in Section 2 was arrived at through rather a random informal survey of some trial courts to try to determine what, if there was a common amount level in which courts have ordered interest to be paid to a party. It, first of all, is infrequent that monies are put in an interest-bearing account. Right now, we think that's probably less than up to 1% is the most is more likely. And it appears that in most cases, these amounts involve $10,000 or more. It's our position that there needs to be some limit on when an interest-bearing account can be ordered to be set up, since the courts don't have accounting resources to handle a system where every trust case is in an individual interest-bearing account. And because of the costs that are involved in setting it up and accounting for that interest, and on the basis of past experience, we believe that $10,000 was a reasonable limit. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Questions by committee members?
All right, thanks for being here. We don't have any other witnesses on House Bill 2185. I haven't had the benefit of the testimony. Shall we put this over for a work session? Yes, so. All right, that's what we'll do. Let's skip back to the first item on our agenda now, the confirmation hearing on Vern Fox. And let's see, who do we have? We got witnesses besides the nominee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Legislative Council has prepared an information sheet for your benefit, which is in your files, just giving you a summary of the nature of the position, statutory qualifications, etc., and background materials on Mr. Foster are also included in your file.
All right, sir, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Vern Fotz, and I am the governor's nominee to fill the vacated position of chairmanship, chair of the Board of Parole. Mr. Kramer indicated when I came in that I could make a statement if I wished. I did not come prepared to do so. I would like to say, however, that this is an exciting opportunity for me. I look forward to this position with a great deal of enthusiasm. I consider this job to be an extremely important one, and I consider the role to be, or certainly to offer, a great many opportunities for me over the next 4 years. And so I look forward to this, the assumption of this responsibility.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brockman.
Mr. Fotz, is that right, Fotz?
That's correct.
Pardon me. I'm looking through these your resume here, and there's an area in here, it's rather lengthy, pardon me if I can't come right up with it, where you're asked to indicate a source listed as contributing 50% or more of your annual household income that does or could reasonably be expected to do business with the public body. And you list yourself with the Clackamas County Mental Health Center and your spouse with the Oregon State Hospital. In your personal resume, your present employment history says that at the Clackamas County Mental Health Center, it's a system of care that includes services provided by state, county, so on. And your position with a private contractor in mental health programs, 78 and 79, worked in a program to help persons leaving correctional facilities. I just wonder if maybe those don't contradict, and we're getting back perhaps to the same argument that that loggers shouldn't be on the Board of Forestry or something like that, but I just wonder how you coincide those by checking and know that that you might not likely be having anything to do with those businesses that expect that contribute more than 50%. I know. Well, I understand that, and he must devote full time to it and engage in no political activity, which he also did in the past. But I'm just going by the question the way it says right here, the source. And I know perhaps in the future, pending confirmation, that may not be viable, but would those people likely be having you assign people to them that you are paroling?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brockman, I am not clear on your question. I guess I'm sorry, but I fail to understand. You're suggesting some conflict.
Well, I'm not suggesting it. I just would like to correlate it in my own mind that where you have worked in the past with parolees and your
I have worked
ties
in the past with persons leaving the penitentiary who were some of them leaving on parole, and my responsibility during that period of time was to work with those people to help them move from the institution to the community. I think it's a requirement of persons that they have some plan that identifies job, place mm-hmm. to live, source of income, those kinds of things, and where alcohol treatment or mental health treatment services were required, that needed to be a part of the plan, and part of my responsibility was to help bridge that gap, locate those resources, and assist the person to make that move.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Cohen?
Tell me a little more about your management, your idea about of managing information. One of the sort of the parole board is the repository, if you will, of at least at the present time, much of the information that we rely on in one way or another, with people who come back into the field, their histories, etc. And for cases where it isn't available, sometimes the board and its staff fills in that information. How do you see yourself as chairman of that board, working with other agencies in terms of sharing of information and trying to build a common information system in the correctional system in this state? I'd like to hear a little bit your vision of how the parole board can fit in the information piece, not necessarily in the other policies, so at least.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, the parole board is a part of a system of care or a system, a correctional system. I think one of the problems, has been that there has not been the cooperation in previous years amongst the pieces of that system that's necessary to make it work effectively. I think my responsibility as chairman of the Board of Parole would be to help make that system work well, and that would certainly include, where that's possible and desirable, the sharing of information. And I'm interested in the kind of information the board gathers and doesn't gather. And I think that one of the first jobs that I have when I step into this role will be to look at our management information system, how it works, what kind of information it now has, and where the deficits are, and also where we fit in terms of the other pieces of the correction system with respect to gathering and sharing information.
I'm sure you're cognizant of the pressures that are visited upon parole board members by the public from time to time, and maybe by editorial writers, and of course judges like to take on the parole board from time to time. I wonder how you would view your ability to follow not only the legislative guidelines, but your own sense of fairness, your own sense of principle in the face of what might be public pressure to act in a certain way.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, that I am no shrinking violet, and that I can and have, under various circumstances, been able to stand on my principles and those things I believe in. I don't give way to pressure. I give way to reason and logic and good sense and things like that, as I think I should. I'm, to be honest, I'm looking forward to this part of the job, because I think that it leads to dialogue, and particularly in the system, the correction system and the criminal justice system, and we need dialogue, and we need a lot of discussion, and I welcome that.
Jim, of course, I'm also certain that you're fully aware of the real serious problems that this legislature faces and the state faces in terms of the prison overcrowding.
Yes, I understand that. Certainly, every day I'm learning more about the many problems.
Any other questions by committee members? Please, Mr. Senator Hamby.
Sir, your background, of course, is most interesting in dealing with clients that have been reviewed by the Psychiatric Review Board. What expertise will you bring to the parole board? What past experiences, perhaps biases, that might in any way affect or change direction of decisions that have been made by our parole board? In other words, how will your past experience and certainly work experience color the decisions made by...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamby, I think that you're probably referring to my experience in my clinical capacity in working with emotionally disturbed people, not my administrative and managerial experience. But you probably know that as many as 40% of the persons in jails and prisons have emotional illnesses. I think that my background in working with that population is helpful in making reasoned decisions about those people. The board often relies heavily on assessments made by psychiatrists and made by psychologists, and I'm very experienced in working with those disciplines and in using the information that they make available. I think that, frankly, my experience, I mean, we're making decisions about human beings here, and my experience in understanding and working with human beings over the last 20 years, people of all kinds, not just the mentally ill, but correctional types also, stands me in good stead in this job. And I think it's a very, it's a significant asset to me.
I guess my, Mr. Chair, I guess my question should have been a little more direct and consequently more difficult to answer. But I guess what I would really like to know is that if you, as a director of the program there in Clackamas County, did you ever find yourself critical, perhaps, of some decisions that the parole board had to make in the way of perhaps decisions on with individuals that you might ultimately be offering services to?
Well, I think there were times when I felt people were on the streets who should not have been on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand the system and how it all worked and how, you know, what the pressures were and how all of those decisions were made. And with respect to the parole board, I still don't. I realize I have a great deal to learn. I think there are times when people need to be in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And